Good afternoon. You are very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Brian Dowling. Published in 2011 at the behest of the Troika, the Legal Services Bill was hailed as the first real attempt to impose reforms on the legal profession. 2 years later, will it ever be enacted? And if it does, will the lawyers have succeeded in watering down the most radical elements? We'll also be talking about the issues that just won't go away: penalty points and the topping up of salaries in the health sector. And danger here, the warnings from the Fiscal Advisory Council on the government's budgetary strategy. First, the news headlines with Susan Jackson.
Thanks, Brian. Good afternoon from the newsroom. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague has said narrow gaps remain between Iran and the six world powers meeting in Geneva to discuss Tehran's nuclear programme. Mr. Hague was speaking after he arrived to negotiate alongside counterparts from the US, Russia, France, China and Germany. The ministers hope to persuade Iran to stop enriching uranium in return for a loosening of sanctions. Mr. Hague said the negotiations were extremely difficult.
Much of the recent history in recent years of Iran's nuclear programme is of concealment and is of defiance of international agreements and resolutions. So, of course, that is why it's important that any agreement is thorough and detailed and comprehensive and covers all aspects of Iran's nuclear program.
The DUP leader Peter Robinson has been addressing his party's annual conference in County Down this afternoon. In his speech, Mr. Robinson defended his party's participation in power sharing. Our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman.
Peter Robinson and Ian Paisley before him led the DUP from the margins of Northern Ireland politics to the centre ground and power. During the past 12 months, in an atmosphere made pungent by the Union flags row, the DUP sometimes resorted to hardline rhetoric and tactics. This conference speech sees Peter Robinson direct the party back towards the middle ground. It's a strategy influenced by next year's local and European elections, when the DUP will see its main opponent as the Ulster Unionist Party. In his speech, Peter Robinson defended his party's participation in power sharing. He also stated there can be no distinction between violence by loyalists and violence by dissident Republicans. Tommy Gorman, RTÉ News, Belfast.
The Latvian ambassador to Ireland has said the Latvian community here is shocked and saddened following Thursday's supermarket roof collapse in the capital Riga, which killed at least 52 people. 3 days of national mourning have begun in Latvia for the victims of the tragedy. Barry Lenehan reports.
A book of condolences will be opened in the Latvian embassy on St. Stephen's Green in Dublin on Monday and Tuesday afternoon for the victims of what's being described as the deadliest disaster in Latvia's modern history. The cause of the collapse has not been confirmed, but police say a garden involving large amounts of soil was being built in the roof. An estimated 25,000 Latvians live here, and the Latvian ambassador to Ireland, Jinsa Pals, said many of them are worried about family and friends living in Riga.
On the social networks, of course, we can already detect the depressed mood and also worries of people concerning their relatives in Latvia. It cannot be excluded that among the victims there are relatives or friends of people presently living in Ireland.
Meanwhile, in Riga, rescue workers have been working around the clock in an effort to find more survivors, but hopes of finding more people alive beneath the rubble are fading.
Gardaí say a fire at a waste recycling facility on the outskirts of Cork City has been extinguished. The blaze broke out around 7:30 last night at the Green Star Waste Recycling Plant at Sarsfield Court in Glanmire. The scene is being preserved for a technical examination to establish the cause of the blaze.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with Dimplex. Get cast iron quality and reduce your heating bills with solid fuel stoves from Dimplex, the name you can trust.
Dry today with a mixture of cloud and sunny spells, cold with highest temperatures 5 to 9 degrees. Tonight will be generally dry with frost occurring under clear skies, lowest temperatures ranging from minus 2 to plus 3 degrees. And that's all from the newsroom. Back to you, Brian.
Thank you, Susan. After this short break, we'll be back with the attempts to reform the legal profession and the continuing row over penalty points. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Saturday with Brian Dowling, and we welcome your views on any of the topics we cover. Here's how you can get in touch. You can text us at 51551. Our email address is saturday@rte.ie, and our Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. Joining us today, Charlie Flanagan, chairman of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, Pádraic McLoughlin, the Sinn Féin spokesman on justice, joining us from Foyle, Ken Murphy, director general of the Law Society, Nolan Blackwell, director general of FLAC, the Free Legal Aid Service, the Free Legal Aid Centres, and Michael Clifford, a journalist with the Irish Examiner. Now, just over 2 years ago, the Legal Services Bill was published and was hailed at the time as the first major attempt to bring about significant reforms in the legal profession. Michael Clifford, what essentially were the main points that the Troika wanted and the government wanted? What were the changes, the key changes?
Well, I suppose to a certain extent, Brian, Alan Shatter used as his blueprint. There was a Competition Authority report in 2006. Now, a lot of people suggest he went beyond that, particularly people in the two arms of the business. But basically speaking, he was going to set up a Legal Service Regulatory Authority, which would oversee the whole legal business, a legal cost adjudicator, independent complaint structure, even though I know Ken would suggest that the complaint structure is already relatively independent, but there's going to be a new system set up and new business forms. And between it all, I suppose one of the main aims would have been to bring down the cost of accessing the legal services and reforming it along lines to a certain extent that has been reformed in the UK over the last decade or so. Having said that, this was the first time that something was actually done. You can go back to the early 70s. I think it was the Fair Trades Commission, as it was then, had made recommendations. There have been a number of reports since. But the 06 report from the Competition Authority was regarded as being a blueprint. And I think to a large extent, that was used. And as well, of course, it had to take the impetus of the Troika, it would appear, to get things done. Alan Shatter, though, to be fair to him, was definitely very much in favour of it. And some would suggest that he may have been too enthusiastic in the way he suggested the formation of the Legal Services Regulatory Authority, in that the minister would have responsibility for appointing a number of members and both arms of the business.
This is one of the key issues at the very beginning.
I think amendments are being proposed to change that element of it, but that was a major bugbear with both arms of the business, I think.
And since then, I think the last time this arose was during the summer, back in July, when this went into committee stage in the Dáil. But it has essentially remained there up to now.
Yeah, it seems to have been. And we're over 2 years down the line. This was supposed to be a big new dawn 2 years ago, but it just has dragged on and on. Now, there have been some amendments. You say it's gone into committee stage. There would always be a suspicion in cases like this that it's being held up by vested interests who don't want it to go forward. And I'm sure Ken and the other arm of the business would suggest that's not the case. But let me put it this way, there's no concrete evidence to suggest anything's been done behind the scenes, but there will always be that suspicion.
Charlie Flanagan, in each of the reports from the Troika, they have placed a particular emphasis on the need to reform legal services. This, if you like, is probably one of the last big pieces of unfinished business from the Troika. They'll be gone next month, and there's still no sign of any progress in terms of moving this legislation forward. What's happening?
Brian, I think there have been two misrepresentations already as far as this issue is concerned. This bill has been actively pursued by the government, by Alan Shatter and by the Dáil. It has been said that it's been held up by vested interests. That's not so. Two of the vested interests are here this afternoon, Ken Murphy and Nolan Blackwell. They'll speak for themselves. It's been also said that now that the Troika have left our shores, that this bill is going on the back burner. Again, nothing could be further from the truth. This is an important and complex piece of legislation. Not 2 months ago, I sat in this studio during the course of the Shannon referendum, and we spoke about the need for Dáil reform. We spoke about the need to ensure that legislation was not guillotined, that there was proper and adequate debate, that there was proper and adequate consultation. What we have here in the Legal Services Regulation Bill is an example of that consultation. The bill was published 2 years ago. It went out for consultation. It's been deliberated upon in the Dáil for a number of days, over a number of weeks.
The Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, will make a point that a lot of resources in the Department of Justice had to go into dealing with the personal insolvency legislation.
That's another point.
People listening to the programme might begin to wonder that if progress has not been made on this legislation while the Troika is here, they might be sceptical about any progress being made once the Troika are gone.
Absolutely not. This isn't the programme for government in any event. And there is a continued urgency in relation to the advancement of this issue. The amendments are currently being drafted by the parliamentary draftsman and the department. They're going to cabinet probably next week. They will be published before Christmas. They will be debated perhaps before Christmas, but if not after Christmas. This so, bill so will be enacted next year.
So the committee stage of this, you expect, will be activated possibly by the end of the year, or by very early next year?
Yes, that's the intention. There were a number of reasons why this matter wasn't progressed further, the most important of which was to allow consultation take place with the stakeholders and in the Dáil and with all of the interested parties. This is an important piece of reforming legislation, which is going to deal with the high cost of going to court on the one hand, and on the other hand, what happens in the event of somebody having a complaint. Over the years, there have been complaints that the Law Society is a representative body on the one hand, therefore how can it be a regulatory or disciplinary body on the other hand? That's a conflict that has been dealt with. I'm happy as a legislator and indeed as a member of the Law Society that these issues are now being advanced in a way that wasn't possible in the past, and we're moving along in the spirit of consultation to ensure that ultimately the public interest is best served.
I want to bring in Ken Murphy, Director General of the Law Society. There has been a long period of consultation. Are you now satisfied, as we approach a period where Charlie Flanagan suggests amendments will now be published to move the legislation forward, are you satisfied that the legislation that may emerge will protect primarily the public interest?
I'd like to say, first of all, that Mick Clifford's exposition of what has happened in the background to it is 100% accurate. I think, except for one little thing, there was just a tiny little outbreak of journalistic paranoia there at the end, where he decided that it was all some sort of dark forces.
We'd never be paranoid.
I'd just like to put on the record, the Law Society is as frustrated as everybody else that this has not moved forward. It has been nothing to do with any machinations and manoeuvrings by the solicitors' profession. This has been exactly as Charlie Flanagan said, the same policy people and drafting people in the Department of Justice and in the AG's office that were supposed to be working on this bill were also working on the personal insolvency legislation, which is considered a higher priority. But we're frustrated that this has not gone forward more quickly. But we're delighted to hear, and the latest information that I have is exactly as Charlie Flanagan's is, which is that amendments are due to be published before Christmas, and that probably immediately after Christmas the committee stage will resume. There's been 1.5 hours of committee stage so
far.
Which was July, and the second stage of the bill finished on the 23rd of February 2012. So there was, that's how long it's been going. I have in front of me here the Law Society submission document, which goes back to February 2012. Yep. We are frustrated. We'd like to see this move forward.
Can I ask you, first of all, at the outset, there was considerable controversy over the proposed composition of the regulatory authority. Mm-hmm. And Alan Shatter, I think, did make some concessions in terms of the way members would be appointed, which, if you like, reduced the ministerial involvement in it.
Yes.
On behalf of the Law Society, are you now happy with how far he has gone on that particular issue?
I think that was an important issue. It was a vital issue when we identified it right from the start. And the legal profession, as I always say, stands in the gap between the relative powerlessness of the individual and the overwhelming power of the state. It has to be free from the reality or even the perception that somehow or other the executive branch of government can control or manipulate legal advice being given to citizens. So that point was made very strongly because the bill was seriously flawed when originally published. However, in the 1.5 hours of amendments that have gone through to committee stage,
the minister has addressed that.
We're waiting to see what the overall package looks like with all passage. We're very happy with the amendments and the approach he's taken so far.
I want to bring in Pádraic McLoughlin, who's joining us from Foyle. Pádraic, you're a member of this committee. What do you think are the key issues that need to be resolved in the amendments coming forward from Alan Shatter?
Well, first of all, can I say that I share the frustration of the contributors there around the delay. 18 months is outrageous from second stage to get to committee stage. Now another few months, and indeed it'll probably end up being 3 months. The main issues that remain, the multidisciplinary practices are a concern in relation to, will it create elitism? Will there be an issue in terms of client privilege? This is where basically
just for a moment, Pádraic, maybe just from the point of view of listeners, you might just explain what a multidisciplinary practice is. What's actually proposed here?
Well, what's proposed, and it seems quite enthusiastically by Minister Shatter, is that essentially now you would have a one-stop shop for all sorts of services, from the solicitor, barrister, through to accountancy and other types of
all working under the same roof.
all under the one roof, and there are issues there. I mean, one of the things, I represent a rural constituency, and right now, as the Bar Council's positioned, you can access the relevant specialist you need through the independent Bar Council. The concern would be, in this new proposition, that the brightest and best would be sucked into the city-based firms that would serve their corporate clients, and the ordinary citizen wouldn't be able to access that level of expertise. That's a real concern that needs to be teased through, certainly, in the next steps.
Nolene Blackwell, Director General of FLAC. Firstly, do you expect to see the kind of radical reform that the public might have anticipated? And what's your view on the notion of creating these multidisciplinary practices?
So, first of all, the first bit of, will it create the radical reform? This is very much a troika-driven process or a business-driven process. And one of the concerns we had when we were before the Oireachtas Committee at the same time as the other people interested in the area was that the bill doesn't even put in as a principle the whole need that legal services must be geared towards access to justice in a big way. And where the bill will be very strong and will be of assistance to the general public as FLAC sees them is in having a complaints authority which is not only independent but perceived to be independent, and also having greater information about legal costs. But where it won't necessarily advance any interest, the way it's structured at the moment, is actually reducing costs for people. And so that point that Padraig McLoughlin was making there about multidisciplinary practices applies to all practices, especially in relation to specialist services. If you have a barrister who's working in a very specialised area of law, be it planning, licensing, there's a whole lot of very specialist areas with small numbers. At the moment, the small practice, the client of the small practice can buy in the expertise they need for an hour or two or three only. Whereas in the way the practices are sort of structured at the moment in the bill, there's a real concern that those people, the specialists, will move off into the big firms who can afford to keep them there.
It will be possible to establish either the big firms already existing or new firms emerging where they buy in the top talent and then they become,
And then they have to charge by the hour. So, for instance, we said in our submission as well, FLAC has always been extraordinarily lucky, so are the independent law centres generally, in getting pro bono services when we want them. We expect we would continue to get them, but the small punter down the country just looking for a small service is in more trouble.
Charlie Flanagan, you are a solicitor, and you have obviously experience of being in a rural practice as well. Is that a concern you share, or do you expect to see change in respect to that?
I'm not sure that these fears are as real as Nolene and Padraig and others think. This is about responding to, you know, emerging business practices. We have it in England, in Wales, in Scotland, in Australia, in Germany, but particularly in the common law jurisdictions, of which ours is one. So we have to adapt to these new emerging business structures. I think a lot of it is about costs. I was talking to a senior counsel during the week who told me that we were particularly fortunate that a case he was involved in didn't go ahead because it was 2 days sitting in the High Court. And I was astounded to learn that 2 days in the High Court now could run into €100,000. We have the Lissadel case last week, the costs of which are not yet been finalised, but it would appear that €6 or 7 million.
Nolene has just made a point that there's no guarantee that this legislation is going to drive down costs.
Well, what it will do is introduce an independent cost adjudicator of a type that we don't have at the moment. At the moment, if there's a dispute about costs, you go to the taxing master. This new cost adjudicator will deal with disputes about costs. There will be a register of determinations, that there will be precedent costs build up. And I think it will, by increasing competition, as well as ensuring that there's a form of cost regulation, I think will have the effect.
Ken Murphy, do you believe that this legislation will actually drive down costs?
Well, just pick up something that Charlie said there. I think the existing taxation of cost system is an independent system, but it can be improved and will be improved by this legislation. Will it have an effect on costs? It may do. But I can tell you something that is driving down costs far more than anything in this legislation in terms of its effects, and that is the recession itself. There's been enormous downward pressure in costs. There's an ever-increasing number of solicitors chasing an ever-reduced amount of work with tremendous downward pressure on costs, and it is market forces which is already reducing downward pressure, introducing downward pressure on costs.
No,
there's a real problem here. The very fact that Charlie and everybody is talking about the cost of litigation. There's nothing in this bill to drive down the cost of litigation. It's a total chill factor for people who are trying to protect and preserve their rights. The fact that litigation can cost them tens of thousands of euros, that is not addressed in this bill and badly needs to be.
Michael Clifford, is there a sense that perhaps access to the courts is really for people who can afford to take, who have the money to do it, or who...
There's no question about that. Only someone can afford the money, or somebody who has no money at all can actually access the courts because they have nothing to lose. But, I mean, I think that thing of the, you know, the debt of the country solicitor, effectively, I think there is some possibility in that. I mean, it mirrors a trend in the economy whereby everything is gravitating towards the centres and particularly Dublin. But I think that idea that if we have these multidisciplinary practices, that definitely could be a problem. Now, the other side of the coin is, though, for example, if you had the likes of the tribunals and they had access to a multidisciplinary process, it shouldn't have cost theoretically much cheaper to get that expertise in. Similarly, people involved in big business, so the benefits for what you might call the ordinary person trying to access the justice with this bill, it'll take a while to feed through and could be a long while.
Pádraic McLoughlin and Pádraic McLoughlin and Foyle, just on this issue of multidisciplinary practices, there are those who might make an argument that there are very few other sectors of the economy that are protected in terms of, if you take small rural towns, small shopkeepers, they have to get on with it if it turns out that a big supermarket moves into their area, if Lidl's or Aldi's moves in or anybody else.
Well, I think that's the issue here is about the relationship, and Ken Murphy referred to this, the relationship between the citizen and the state and the ability to access the, you know, the best possible expertise, no matter where you live in the state, to defend your rights and to defend your case. And I'm concerned at this proposal. But can I just say something else? This particular bill isn't a panacea in relation to cost. In my opinion, the greatest cost issue for people who find themselves before the courts is the logjam in the court system. If you're dealing with family law, the biggest issue, because unfortunately there isn't the proper mediation structure there to resolve the differences at the early stages, so it drags on for years and years through the local court system, and that's what builds up your costs. So we need to deal with the logjams and make the court system in place work more efficiently. We need a mediation bill that allows people to resolve issues before it goes down the road of huge cost.
And we need
Nolene Blackwell.
We need support for the legal aid service. The state funded legal aid service has sometimes delays of people getting representation. They can wait for 18 months for a first appointment with their solicitor for representation. So that needs to be better extended. It's the big difference between legal costs, say, and medical costs. There is a public health system of some sort. The public legal system is extremely expensive.
There hasn't been much talk. There's been a lot of debate about the cutbacks in the medical system and the effect it's having on the health system in this country. There hasn't yet been sufficient debate about the cutbacks that are taking place in the justice system and the effect that that's having on justice and access to justice in this country.
Charlie Flanagan, what concessions do you expect or do you anticipate that the Minister, Alan Shatter, might make in terms of the amendments on some of the issues that are still outstanding, particularly in terms of the multidisciplinary practices, perhaps also in relation to disciplinary procedures?
Well, I think considerable progress has been made with the vested interests over the past number of months while the legislation was under debate and while amendments were being prepared. I would accept that the level of consultation will continue. The committee stage will start, if not before Christmas, certainly after Christmas. And there will be further opportunity for the Law Society, the Bar Council, the Free Legal Aid Services, etc., to make their pitch. But I think overall, this is a bill not geared towards the legal profession. This is a bill geared towards the citizen and the consumer of the services. There's a perception here that the multidisciplinary practice model will actually change entirely the manner in which legal services are given. It's important to remember that both members of the bar and of the solicitor's profession will still be entitled to deliver services in the manner in which we now have it.
There'll be no compulsion on them, in other words, to form these groups.
Will still be there. Pádraic mentions the delay. I accept that there is a delay bringing cases to court. I think the recently passed referendum is a move in the right direction.
On establishing the Court of Appeal.
The Minister for Justice is committed to introducing a new family law division, which will greatly improve the level of service in the family law area.
Very quickly, I want to just move on a little bit, and I've no doubt we'll be coming back to this issue later on when this goes before the committee stage. But another issue during the week related to the whole controversy over penalty points. And we had a situation at the Public Accounts Committee where the Garda Commissioner asked for the return of a box of files relating to the penalty points issue. And the Public Accounts Committee, no member of the committee has possession of or has seen these files, but they have given them to their parliamentary legal advisor for advice with a view to perhaps handing them over to the Controller and Auditor General. Michael Clifford, could this possibly end up in the courts, this dispute between the Guards and the Public Accounts Committee?
Oh, it could. And a similar one, not slightly similar, was the issue that arose in Donegal, and people went to Brendan Howlin and Jim Higgins, who were both opposition TDs at the time, and ultimately that went all the way
to the Supreme Court. And this was in terms of their sources of information.
Now, having said that, look, I'd be surprised. What I was surprised at initially, the Garda Commissioner wrote to John McGuinness on foot of a story we had in the Irish Examiner that said Mr McGuinness had possession, or the committee had possession, of these files. If you look at the law, both the Garda Síochána Act 05 and the Data Protection Act in 1988, there is provision in both of those for a person to go to a member of the Oireachtas with confidential files if there is at issue monies owed to the state or foregone by the state, which would be the case here. So legally,
I think to explain from the point of view of listeners, the Public Accounts Committee interest in this, I think as expressed by John McGuinness, is what money, if any, has been forgone from the state in terms of the collection of revenue from penalty points, and whether or not there's a system failure or there's a difficulty with the system of penalty points.
Exactly, and the narrative of it goes back to, we all know, the whistleblowers went to members of the Oireachtas as a result of pressure. Alan Shatter set up an internal Garda investigation into it, and everything that has flowed from that is a feeling, and the whistleblowers have made this known, and other sections, I think Pádraig McLoughlin among them, have suggested that that was a whitewash, and everything has flowed from that. Now, the Comptroller and other General has already done a report, and he came into possession of files, and it seems there was no objection to that. So apart from the aspect of this probably facing a public airing, one has to wonder why there seems to be such an objection.
Pádraig McLoughlin and Foyle, you raised this on Leaders' Questions the other morning. What would you like to see happening now?
Well, what I would like to see happening is that the Public Accounts Committee can do their job. They have been given access to documentation, which also the Comptroller and Auditor General has. And that's the reason why the Comptroller and Auditor General found that one in five, this is incredible, these a couple of statistics I'm about to give you, one in five motorists facing traffic offences got off, and half of all summonses in relation to traffic offences were not served. So you have a system that is just malfunctional, that these two Garda whistleblowers, in my view, had exposed. They were talked down, they were dismissed, and that report that the Public Accounts Committee now want to investigate, I believe, has vindicated them.
So you'd like to see that move into public hearings with the Public Accounts Committee,
would
you?
Yes, absolutely. And the other issue, too, is that it has been reported in the public domain that, unfortunately, some senior journalists, judges, a state solicitor, and other people in high places in public life, had penalty points terminated, and that leaves the situation out there for people that the law doesn't apply equally to everybody. The vast majority of people who got penalty points actually paid them, but unless we have a system that is very clear that every single person faces the same prosecution with nobody to protect them or to prevent that happening, then we have a real problem.
Nolene Blackwell, and I want to come to Nolene and Ken Murphy. Doesn't this come down to the old maxim that justice has to be seen, not to be done, but to be seen to be done, that people have to feel that there's a level playing pitch out here?
That's really important. The question of fairness is, I think, what exercises people more than anything else, this perceived unfairness. The guards are a most important function in our society, and they have to be respected as a key important control within our society. But there have to be ways as well that the police are held to account. And in any good functioning authority or society where the rule of law applies, there has to be oversight of the police as well. And I think the concern at the moment is, how does that happen?
Ken Murphy.
I think the it like so much else in life, it's an issue of balance. On the one hand, if there are people within the Gardaí who feel that there is a system that's not functioning and that they don't and they're bringing it to the attention of people within the system, can't resolve it, there is an entitlement to bring it elsewhere into an Oireachtas committee. However, there are also the rights of the people who are referred to in these cases, you know, data protection rights and so on. We can't have situations
where... the people who are identified and named in this documentation.
Well exactly. And we can't have a situation where information is possibly being taken from within the PulseGuard, the confidential system, and being given to politicians.
But does provision for us,
Provided that it is being done in appropriate cases and for appropriate motives, because the potential for abuse here is enormous.
Oh, yeah.
Brian, can I just point out...
Pádraig McLoughlin.
Very briefly, the two Garda whistleblowers themselves, in early 2012, brought these matters to the attention of the appropriate authority, the internal Garda confidential recipient. For months and months, they were stonewalled. Only after that, they then, which is under Section 62 of the Garda Síochána Act 2005, they then, as was their right, brought these matters to the attention of members of the Oireachtas. And that's how the issue came into the public domain. And now we have a situation, which is the good news about all of this, is there's now clear directives issued across in Garda Síochána around these matters, and I actually don't believe what has happened will repeat itself in the future, and that's thanks to those two very brave men who now have documentation that should be further examined so all the lessons are learned. What we have right now has been an internal Garda investigation, and that isn't appropriate. We can't have an institution investigating itself. We need an independent...
I want to bring in Charlie Flanagan there. Yeah. Charlie Flanagan, where do you think the government should go from here in relation to this issue? Like, would you like to see the Public Accounts Committee bring this into the public domain?
I'm satisfied that there has been an investigation into this issue and that the procedures have been improved so as to ensure a fair and just application of the law. There needs to be confidence in the process, and I think in order to maintain the confidence, there has to be some engagement with the Oireachtas now that these documents are in possession of a Dáil committee. There's the question of privilege, there's the question of data protection. I would expect that will be resolved over the next 10 days. Yes, I would like to see a Dáil committee dealing with it, but more than anything else, what we need to ensure is that there's confidence in the process. We cannot have a situation where there's one law for one set of people, another for others. Where there obviously has to be, and this was contained in the internal Garda investigation, the recognition that there may be emergency
exceptional circumstances.
Or discretionary circumstances.
Charlie, everybody says that, but in the context of what was done, Charlie, there is discretion. There's allowance for discretion. Yeah. The ludicrous manner in which discretion was exercised is what is at issue here.
I accept all, that there are difficulties as far as
And the other
as
thing
that's
is, all of the reason this is dragging on is because, like any state agency, the record of internal investigations is pretty poor. And when you compare the internal Garda investigation even to the limited amount of information the Comptroller and Auditor General had, you see that he came up with far more abuse of the system, and that's the reason it has gone on, because initially the Minister for Justice should have appointed an outside agency to look at this, and he didn't, and he backed the internal investigation.
Charlie Flanagan, finally, just on this issue, do you believe that the remaining issues to be resolved, both in terms of how this system may operate in the future and the issues dealing with the information now in possession of the Public Accounts Committee, it would be better, from everybody's point of view, to trash that out within the confines of the Public Accounts Committee, subject to the legal advice that they may have?
I believe it would, but I think it's absolutely imperative that they be on strong legal ground, and that's why I understand presently legal advice is being sought on the issue of privilege, on the issue of data protection. There has to be fair procedures in this issue. But ultimately, we must have a just and even application of the law.
OK, that brings to an end our discussion on legal reforms and penalty points. I'd like to thank Ken Murphy and Nolan Blackwell for joining us. After this short break, salary top-ups in the health sector and those danger warnings over the budget. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Saturday with Brian Dowling. Charlie Flanagan, Pádraig McLoughlin and Michael Clifford are still with us here. And we're also joined by Donal Donovan, a member of the Fiscal Advisory Council. Now, last night, the Department of Health confirmed that more than half of the country's voluntary hospitals and health agencies, 22 out of 24, admitted to breaching the public pay guidelines in relation to topping up pay for senior executives. And at this stage, 8 have not responded yet. Charlie Flanagan, a lot of people who are in the lower and middle grade pay levels of the public sector and who've taken reasonably big hits over recent years, would they be justified in feeling very sore about what they're seeing now?
I think they would, because I believe much of what's been reported is nothing short of preposterous. That money from the sweet shops, that money from the car parks is going in to top up the managers of the hospitals, having regard to the fact that people lower down the line have already, like all public service, taken pretty severe cuts over the past number of years. I think there are two issues here. There's the payment itself on the one hand, which needs to be addressed, but also there's the secrecy surrounding it. And I am satisfied that both the Taoiseach and the Minister for Health are dealing with this issue in a way that will ultimately come to conclusion. Obviously, the replies that the Minister has received to date, they have to be checked. There are a number of outstanding hospitals and institutions.
I think there are eight who have not yet responded, which in itself is quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I believe it will happen next week, because there is a determination on the part of James Reilly to deal with this issue. He has got to the bottom of it insofar as we do know that these payments have been made.
Are you surprised, it would appear, that senior officials in the Department of Finance, the Department of Public Expenditure and even Health were not aware that this was going on this scale?
I am surprised of it. Yeah, well, there was, mind you, in the Hicwa Tara report earlier this year.
Apart, of course, from the one which they approved themselves. We know of one incident.
Yeah, and that did result in a national audit taking place. So I suppose until the national audit did take place, it wasn't possible to quantify it. But I just think it's simply not good enough for car parking fees to go into the pockets of the managers of the hospitals. The pay policy from the Department of Health to the HSE is clear. It has been agreed. It's of a contractual nature. And
but there's
a
very, very serious difficulty now, because these people are being paid this money at this stage. So how do you move this forward? Can you withdraw it?
Well, yes, that must be one of the options. I think the first thing to do is to establish the facts, and then you look at what actually is going to happen. I do believe they should be withdrawn. I believe it should be stopped in instances where it's categorically proven that it has taken place. And that includes such things as benefits in kind, like the payment of golf club fees, the payment for cars or other ancillary benefits. All this needs to be quantified, because it's a matter of
considerable
concern. Patrick
McLaughlin and Boyle, what do you make of what has happened?
Well, I suppose if you look at the reality that the gap between the highest paid and lowest paid in our public sector is amongst the, you know, that gap is amongst the widest in Europe. We have a situation where, you know, the bankers' bonuses continued without the appropriate intervention by government. The issue of ministerial advisers, where they broke the pay scale and the salary scale repeatedly, you know, for their own advisers. That is the culture that prevails. So it's no shock to me. But what it will do is cause further anger and resentment across people, particularly low-paid public sector workers out there.
But isn't there a real difficulty here for the government as well? Because senior executives working throughout the health sector who are the recipients of these top-ups, they are now being paid this money. And if you take, for instance, say Sinn Féin's budget proposal, Sinn Féin proposed cutting public sector pay by 15% for those who might earn between 100,000 and 150,000 euro, and by 30% for those earning above 150,000 euro. Now, if you were to implement, and you're not in government, those kind of proposals, I mean, would we not then be looking at perhaps an exodus of the most senior executives from some of the jobs across the public sector?
Well, we repeatedly hear that if we ask people at the very high end of salary scales in our society, the very wealthy, to pay their fair share in taxation, that they'll leave. But I mean, you know, I just don't believe that stacks up. I just don't think it makes sense. I think if you look across our state, we have a crisis. We have 300,000 of our people have emigrated in the last 4 years. There's no bleeding heart for them. So we just need to have a fair and progressive taxation system that funds, you know, efficiently run quality public services. And we don't have that. We have a fear of dealing with that. But hopefully, over the next number of years, one of the outflowings of this crisis will be an end to that sense of entitlement and privilege at the top of our public sector, and indeed led by our government ministers.
Donald Donovan of the Fiscal Advisory Council, it's not a direct issue for the council. Nonetheless, the issue of public sector pay, to the extent that it's a big component of public spending and government spending, that is an issue.
Well, you're right. The Fiscal Council's mandate doesn't extend to discussing individual sectoral issues. But one thing that the council is very keen on in general is the issue of transparency. And clearly, and I share what Charlie Flanagan had said, it seems fairly evident here that there was a major lack of transparency as regards exactly who was getting paid what. And I think that's independent from the separate issue, which can be debated as to what the appropriate level of salaries should be for people in these jobs. That's a separate question. But we need to know what everybody's earning. And I think that's essential for public credibility and confidence in the management of the state's financial affairs. I must say personally, I find it very surprising indeed how this could not have been fairly well known to a reasonable number of people.
Michael Clifford.
I'd also find it very surprising how it couldn't have been known. And the other issue is the government can't speak with any moral authority on this. When you look at the situation with government advisers, it seems that this is something that has persisted through the years of the recession, whereas others, like, for instance, the breaching the salary cap in the banks for government advisers in some semi-state bodies, all of that has come to the fore. And what emerges is a picture that suggests that these salary caps are merely a PR exercise to ensure that there is not an outbreak of anger among those particularly in the lower levels of the public service, because they're taking such cuts, and yet those at the top appear to be still enjoying relatively well-paid positions.
Charlie Flanagan, 2 points. First of all, the point that Michael Clifford made there about the government itself, in respect of some advisers, broke its own pay guidelines in terms of approving salary increases above it in respect of some individuals. And the other issue is a lot of callers are ringing and they're making the point that a concern about the effect this might have on some charitable donations to hospitals. Now, I think most of the hospitals have said the money that is being used to top up people's salary is not coming from charitable donations.
I think it's very important that be made clear, because it has been suggested earlier in the week that the proceeds of charitable donations and bequests were being used to pay salaries at top level. I think that has been denied, and mm-hmm. you know, let's ensure that denial is correct, because particularly at this time of the year.
And secondly, the issue of the government's moral authority.
Well, listen. The government's moral authority isn't an issue here, because it's the secrecy of the payments. It's the fact that this actually wasn't known. I mean, there are exceptional circumstances where the guidelines have been exceeded, where
exceptional.
A business case is put forward. Yes, they have been very exceptional.
At least seven advisors, and
they have been in the health service and throughout other aspects of the public service. But it's the fact that this, as far as frontline health services are concerned, that it was done in a way that wasn't disclosed, it was done in a way that was underhand, it was done in a way that was kept secret. That's the issue here, and that's why a clear picture of all payments made must emerge.
Now, Michael Clifford, before you leave us, Michael, yesterday Tom Gilmartin passed away, who was one of the key witnesses to the Mahon flood tribunals. Very, very quickly, Michael, his legacy.
His legacy, I suppose, I mean, obviously the man had his own personal legacy in terms of he was very successful. He was a man who was forced to go to Britain, even though his prospects here were probably better than the vast majority of others. He showed intellectual potential at an early age, but he did well over there. He came back here. He ran into difficulty, a lot of corruption. His ultimate legacy will be that he was key in unravelling the finances of Bertie Ahern. He made allegations which weren't ultimately substantiated, but which led to investigations of Bertie Ahern's finances and ultimately led to Mr. Ahern's resignation. He also gave a very much an insight into the type of corruption and the way that things were done here when he came back. And it has to be said, he was something of a visionary. If he had come back to this country 10 years later, he would have entered a country that was ready for takeoff in terms of the type of visions he had for developing various sites. But, you know, I mean, unfortunately, and a man who has done a lot of wrong when he was giving evidence in the tribunal. And, you know, I think he ultimately seems to have been vindicated.
Michael Clifford, thank you very much. Returning back to Donald Donovan from the Fiscal Advisory Council. Now, Donald, what are the key concerns that the council outlined yesterday about the budgetary strategy now being pursued by the government over the next year?
The main concern was that the decision not to implement 3.1 billion of adjustment measures in the budget for 2014, but to instead go for the lower figure of 2.5, essentially reduces the margin of safety that the government has had up to now, in terms of meeting the critically important 3% deficit target in 2015. And that's very important for our international credibility and creditworthiness. The lower adjustment this year in terms of underlying adjustment means that really when you look at the budget next year, if there's any slippage at all from the official growth projection of 2%, then the government of GDP growth is not going to be able to meet the 3% target next year unless it takes additional measures beyond the 2 billion that is already planned for.
I think looking at the fiscal council's, the fiscal advisory council's documentation yesterday, it seems to me that you've focused in that there are two big ifs. One you've just mentioned, which is, do we get 2% growth next year? And the other one is, can the government sustain the kind of savings that it hopes to sustain? And we've all seen the situation with the health budget. If there's slippage on those two fronts, are the public looking at a situation whereby the kind of budgetary measures next year in terms of spending cuts and perhaps additional taxation will be far harsher than anything that they might have imagined this year?
Well, they would be certainly harsher. How much harsher, of course, depends how the figures would work out, and one can make all kinds of different calculations. But clearly, if growth were to be much below 2%, and if, say, there were the continuing slippages, as you've mentioned, perhaps in the health area seems to be the one of most focus, then yes, the adjustment would, have to be more than 2 billion, quite a bit more than 2 billion perhaps next year. And it would could be even more, actually, to make up for, say, slippages in the health, if there were any.
Charlie Flanagan, just looking at the, over the last while, the Fiscal Council has advised and did advise about going for 3.1 billion. The governor of the central bank indicated recently that he would probably have gone much further towards that. The ESRI had indicated that would be their preference, plus a number of international bodies. Who exactly does the government listen to when it comes to make this decision?
Oh, you can take it, Brian, from me that the government takes the advice of the Fiscal Council very, very seriously. There's absolutely no doubt about that, and that is accepted. Now, obviously, the government isn't mandated.
The government is free to reject advice.
Yes.
A number of very reputable, independent bodies have all suggested that it would have been better and it would have been safer to go for a 3.1 billion adjustment.
Yeah, and you know, it may well have been good for the government to take that advice. But if we did take that advice, what would have happened? We would have had more hospital bed closures. We would have had more Garda station closures. We would have had to make an adjustment downwards of the old age pension. The government wasn't prepared to do that simply because we've had sufficient austerity, which has hit every family in the country over the past number of years.
So cutting to the chase, if you take the points made by the Fiscal Advisory at Council, cutting to the chase, is the net issue this, that the government is taking a punt that we'll get 2% growth next year and that it will be able to bring about the savings it anticipates?
Well, also what the government did as part of the budget and in addition to the fiscal adjustment that Donald speaks of, there was the introduction of a 500 million jobs package which will support economic growth. It is all about growth. Yes, of course there are risks attached. I was interested during the week to hear the Fiscal Council speak about the credit line and the fact that you know, we didn't go for the insurance. You know as well as I do, Brian, if you have an insurance policy, you pay the premium price. It costs money. Remember the opposition said it was like jumping out of a plane without a parachute. I'd rather look at it from a more positive point of view. We're more self-confident now. We stand on our own 2 feet. Rather than talk about jumping without a parachute, it was like getting your licence back, having had it suspended over the past number of years by the EU, EMF and Troika. Yeah. We're now back. We're confident.
I want to bring in Pádraig McLoughlin there, Charlie. I want to bring in Pádraig McLoughlin. Pádraig McLoughlin, Sinn Féin also favoured going for a 2.5 billion adjustment. In light of what people like the Fiscal Advisory Council and others are now saying, do you have any second thoughts about that decision?
Well, the Fiscal Advisory Council, you know, have their analysis. That, you know, they're pro-austerity. They've given this advice repeatedly to the government. They don't seem to have any sense of responsibility, though, for their policies in terms of the impact on the real economy and people's lives.
I mean, but do you accept that the government might be taking a big gamble and a big risk on the budgetary strategy it's now pursuing?
No. Sinn Féin have had a consistent analysis that the government have been wrong to date in their approach, repeated austerity. They haven't had a real strategy for growth. We haven't looked at our National Pension Reserve Fund. We haven't looked at the European Investment Bank or, you know, private pension funds to see can we get our economy moving. If you talk to any small business or anybody out there in the community across the state, they'll tell you that we've been strangled for all of these years. I mean, there are other opinions out there. Eminent economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winning economists, have been very critical. I would say this, Einstein has been repeated so many times in recent years, this definition of insanity, repeating the same behaviour again and again and expecting different results. And that's what the Fiscal Advisory Council are proposing, and we would disagree with them very strongly.
Donald Donovan, the Fiscal Advisory Council poster boys or girls for austerity?
No, We all know that there is a difficult choice between, on the one hand, trying to limit the damage to growth, and on the other hand, making sure that our creditworthiness is restored. Because unless you restore your creditworthiness, it's no use having a deficit of 5, 6, 7%, because nobody will lend you the money to pay for it. And that's a fundamental problem that we've been in the last 3 years, and we haven't really had the choice of saying, let's you know, go for huge Greek growth, let's not reduce the budget deficit. The fact is that we had a creditworthiness problem, 125% of GDP. So there's a choice here. Now, I actually think, and we do say this in the report, that the government, broadly speaking, is following the prudent approach. And we're mandated by law to make an assessment of that. And mind you, if we didn't think that was true, we would say it loud and clear. But we do. Where we have disagreed with is on the margin with respect to two issues, 2.5, 3.1, and also the credit line. Can I mention a little bit the credit line since it was raised? We said that this would be a valuable insurance against unforeseen events, assuming it was granted on reasonable terms and conditions. And I think most people would agree with that, including, I think, Charlie. One of the difficulties was, though, that we didn't quite know what the terms and conditions were going to be.
I don't think we got any information on the terms.
Well, the problem,
conditions.
Well, we knew in general terms, I think, that the content would be broadly the same as what actually is going to be in the government's programme anyway, because it's bound by certain fiscal rules in the EU. It has a programme on legal services, mortgage arrears and other things. But what we didn't quite know is when it would come to the crunch and we would negotiate with the EMS, where Germany is very influential, what the impact might be of a new government in Germany.
The establishment of a new German government, that appears to have been the biggest stumbling block.
Unfortunately, it seems a couple of months away, and I think the government may well have felt that they didn't want to expose themselves to uncertainty, potential controversy, debates in the German parliament, which could have indeed included things like the Irish corporate tax regime, because the opposition party that's now going to join with SPD, with Mrs. Merkel, you know, has said in its campaign that it was very unhappy about Ireland's corporate tax regime. Now, that may not get into the programme for government, because we well know that many things that are in election campaigns don't make it into the programme of government.
Yep.
But still, this uncertainty was there, and I suspect that that played a role in what ultimately had to be a political decision of balancing the risks. But I think the economic and financial benefit of our proposal, of the proposal of the Fiscal Council, I think would not be seriously contested by many in the government, actually.
I wouldn't disagree with that at
Charlie
all.
Flanagan.
I think, again, it's worth reiterating that it was a finely balanced decision on the precautionary credit line. You know, people spoke about umbrellas. You go into a shop, you buy an umbrella, you pay for an umbrella. And the government looked at the best option that was available to Ireland and indeed our future progress, both domestically and internationally. Looking at the council, I think it's fair to say, and indeed John McHale himself said it yesterday morning, that the government and the Fiscal Council are broadly in agreement on fiscal policy, on economic policy. Obviously, there's going to be a difference of opinion from time to time, but not on the overall policy. And remember, government is the you know, elected body that ultimately makes decisions.
Pádraic McLoughlin, Sinn Féin also favoured going without a precautionary line of credit and going into the markets on our own. And the market sentiment right now is pretty good. But if it changes, we will be left very exposed, won't we?
Well, just to say, the difficulty with the so-called precautionary line of credit is it's actually a conditional line of credit. And we already have enough of our economic sovereignty ceded. Remember that we are subject to the Fiscal Compact Treaty, which will ensure that we have to keep our deficits after 2015 unsustainably low. We're going to have to look at this unsustainable debt burden, continuing to pay it down. We will have twice a year our budget supervised by Brussels and others until we've paid 75% of that banking debt. And indeed, we don't have a deal in relation to the European Stability Mechanism and that retrospective recapitalisation that we thought we had last year and were assured we had by the government. So, I mean, the reality for us is that we have already, even with the removal of the Troika, we will have ceded substantial amounts of our economic sovereignty moving forward. This would have been another layer, and we just need to remove those layers of control, external control, and get more and more of our own sovereignty back.
I want to give the last word to Donal Donovan very, very quickly, Donal. The stress tests on European banks next year, how big a risk might that pose? Very quickly.
It's really uncertain. We don't know the methodology. We don't know how conservative the people doing the stress tests will be. Would they say, for example, let's assume there's a recession in Europe. we've got to give the banks enough capital to take account of that. Or they can, maybe they could say, no, let's assume we just stay where we are. It's going to be a complicated thing. It's going to be a political decision, I think, at the end of the day, with a lot of at the European level. In Ireland, we simply have no idea what will happen.
OK, that's our lot for today. Thank you for listening and thanks to all our guests for joining us. We'll be back at the same time next Saturday when we'll be coming live from the Labour Party conference in Killarney. I hope you can join us then. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your weekend.